Our next case for argument is Gilbert against Cook. Ms. Cottrell.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. The District Court committed two reversible errors in this case. First, the Court wrongly excluded all evidence relating to an altercation at Gilbert's cell pursuant to Heck v. Humphrey. The second error is related to the first. The District Court abused its discretion by refusing to appoint counsel, especially given the difficulty of the Heck issue before Gilbert. Unless the Court would like me to do otherwise, I'd like to address the Heck issue first. Under Heck v. Humphrey, a plaintiff may not maintain a 1983 action where a judgment in favor of the plaintiff would necessarily imply the invalidity of his prior conviction. In this case, Gilbert pled no facts nor presented any evidence at trial which would meet this standard. To begin with, Gilbert did not deny the assault in his complaint. Likewise, he did not deny the assault in his opening argument. And Gilbert did not deny the assault when he testified because he wasn't given the opportunity to do so prior to the Heck ruling. So what evidence was presented to the jury which would factor into this Heck determination? The defendants told the jury twice during opening argument that Gilbert assaulted Cook. Gilbert himself elicited testimony on multiple occasions regarding the details, the location, and the timing of the punch. This testimony was uncontradicted. The District Court, after both officers testified, ruled that all evidence relating to the Chuck Hole incident was barred. This was an error for three reasons. The District Court's ruling was overbroad. The defendant's motion in limine was rather limited in scope. It only requested that Gilbert be precluded from denying the assault, but the District Court barred all evidence relating to the Chuck Hole. The ruling that the thrust, which is the words of the District Court, of Gilbert's case was that this did not happen, there's no evidence to suggest that. To begin with, Gilbert at the colloquy told the court, "I'm not going to deny that I assaulted the officer." That's at appendix page 100. Also, midway through trial, Gilbert asked the court a question about Heck. He said, "Would you tell my witnesses that they can't say anything about this, that they can't deny the assault?" That's at appendix page 148. He was concerned about running afoul of Heck, and throughout trial, he told the court that he didn't want to. Moreover, he presented no evidence that would deny the assault. Finally, the District Court's judgment is not supported by the law. The District Court relied on Okoro, this court's decision in Okoro versus Callahan. Okoro simply stands for the proposition that the question is not whether a plaintiff could theoretically avoid Heck, it's whether he did. The plaintiff is a master of his own ground. Gilbert did. He avoided Heck. He didn't plead it in his complaint. He didn't mention it during trial. He didn't present any witnesses who got on the stand and denied it. In fact, he elicited testimony time and time again that the punch did happen. I want to also call to the court's attention that Gilbert asked the court, How can I avoid Heck? Can I ask questions about the punch? What if I show the punch is impossible? Reading from appendix page 100. So if I say, okay, I punched him, and then I get up there and I prove that their story is impossible, how would that be weighed? The court. That would be up to a jury. Gilbert, no, I'm asking you, would my case be tossed out by Heck? The court. All I'm saying is you can't deny the conduct. Gilbert never denied the conduct. A finding that the thrust of his case was that this didn't happen makes no sense. If that was the thrust of his case, why didn't he bring that up in his complaint? Why didn't he bring that up in opening argument? For all these reasons, we submit the finding on Heck v. Humphrey was an error. Unless the court has any further questions regarding this issue. I'd now like to turn to the recruitment of counsel issue. Gilbert requested counsel three times during trial. First, in an affidavit attached to his complaint. Second, at the pretrial hearing, the court ruled on this motion, finding that, quote, particularly in light of the relative straightforward nature of this case, Gilbert's competent to handle it. I want to point out to the court that when the court made this finding, The Heck issue was already before it. It had been raised at the pretrial hearing. Gilbert again requested counsel during the pretrial colloquy. I'd like to focus on this request because it was at this point that it really became apparent Gilbert wasn't competent to handle this on his own. During the colloquy, on page 98, Gilbert states,
"Well, you know that one of the holdings of Pruitt against Moat is that the district court is not required to continually reassess things as the case proceeds."
Yes,
it sounds like you're making an argument that's inconsistent with the approach in Pruitt.
Of course,
that would all be irrelevant if we were to remand on the merits.
I would respectfully disagree. I think this is a case where Gilbert asked that the court reconsider. Again, quoting Gilbert on page 98, "I'd like the court to reconsider its decision regarding recruitment of counsel." In Pruitt, I believe it was Judge Rovner who pointed out that
there's a reason she was writing separately. The majority didn't agree with her.
Either way, Your Honor, Gilbert requested counsel again at the pretrial colloquy. On page 98, "I'd like the court to reconsider appointing me an attorney." The district court did not even acknowledge this request. In Pruitt, this court remanded because the district court only acknowledged half of the test. In this case, it didn't even acknowledge his request. And in any event, like I pointed out before, the Heck issue was before the court. It knew there was a possible, incredibly difficult Heck issue when it ruled the facts of this case were straightforward. As this court has noted, Heck issues, especially given certain factual situations, can be incredibly complicated. This was one of those complicated factual situations. The underlying conviction and the excessive force claim are factually intertwined, and it needs a plaintiff to understand the differences between Okoro, McCann, and Van Gilder. Gilbert tried, but he's a person who's been in jail since he was 14 years old. He has no formal education, and he simply did not understand this. He told the court that multiple times during the colloquy before he again asked for reconsideration of the appointment of counsel issue. He said, "This isn't making sense. I can't come up with nothing. Man, to be honest, I don't know what the thrust of my case is no more." His confusion is also evident by the fact that he was citing cases that have no bearing on this. Even the district court noted that. The court recognized Gilbert's confusion at other times, stating, "You're confusing this with something else. Don't confuse this with your prior criminal conviction." The difficulty of this case is also aggravated by the fact that the district court told Gilbert 13 times all that mattered was his testimony. It asked him on multiple occasions, "What are you going to testify? What are you going to say when you get on the stand?" Gilbert never got on the stand, and his case was still barred. Turning quickly to the prejudice prong, there can be no question a lawyer would have made a difference in the outcome. Gilbert expressed on numerous occasions a preference not to get his case thrown out. Had he had an attorney, they would have helped him navigate the Heck waters so his claim wouldn't have been barred. As Gilbert said at the end of trial, "I honestly believe if I had an attorney, things would have been totally different." He was right. Unless the court has further questions on this, I'd like to remain the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Petrello. Mr. Siegel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Evan Siegel, counsel. I represent Officers Cook, Walker, and Phelps. Your Honors, the district court correctly barred Gilbert's claims under Heck because the centerpiece of Gilbert's Eighth Amendment claim case was that he didn't hit Cook. He was eager.
I must say I don't understand that. The district court seems to have thought that once it's judicially established for purposes of Heck that Gilbert hit one of the guards, that nothing could be shown thereafter. That at least was the ruling. You can't show anything that happened once you reach the top of the stairs and got to the chuck hole. And that amounts to saying that if a prisoner strikes a guard, the guard can beat the prisoner to a pulp, indeed could kill him on the spot, with no possibility of a claim under 1983. I don't see how that can be right.
I disagree respectfully, Your Honor. There was a way for Mr. Gilbert to bring this case without running...
Disagree with what?
Mr. Gilbert could have prosecuted his civil case by focusing simply on whether or not the guards used a reasonable degree of force, whether under the...
How could he do all those things after he's told he couldn't present any evidence of anything that happened above the stairs? I mean, he threw the case out, seems to me.
That is what occurred, Judge Cudahy. But the case was thrown out because Mr. Gilbert persisted in going into this issue of whether or not...
There are two possibilities. One is that as a matter of law, Heck says that after a prisoner strikes a guard, then the guard can do anything he pleases to the prisoner without any risk of recovery. The other possibility is that the magistrate judge is imposing a sanction for litigation misconduct, for the plaintiff's failure to abide by a ruling of the court. I can't see any hint that this was a sanction for litigation misconduct. And, of course, if that's how you care to describe it, you're playing into your adversary's hands on the attorney question, because an attorney would not have done any such thing. But I can't see in the magistrate judge's ruling any suggestion that this was a penalty for defiance of his orders. It appears to be his understanding of Heck. And that brings us back to the question, can it be that Heck says that if a prisoner beats a guard, the guard can do anything he wants in response?
Certainly not, Your Honor, under this court's decision.
That's the consequence of the district court's ruling. If the district court says, you cannot introduce any evidence of what happens after the moment when you struck the guard, or after the moment when you got in a position to strike the guard, that's a legal ruling that a guard can do anything he wants in response to being hit. And we all agree it can't possibly be right.
I think the problem here, Your Honor, was that the cat was out of the bag. There was no curative, short of instructing the jury, disregard the fact that Mr. Gilbert said 6 times or 7 times that this was an alleged punch, that he did put evidence on in violation of the court's order. Evidence is cross-examination, certainly challenging the fact that the punch ever occurred. At that point, I don't know what other option the court had, because Mr. Gilbert had been warned explicitly, 7 or 8 different times, if it's your intent to deny that the punch occurred, this case is going to evaporate into thin air. If you deny, at page 95 of the appendix, what I'm telling you is you can't get on the stand and deny the conduct. And I disagree with counsel's characterization, or these warnings didn't take place simply in the context of if you get on the stand. The judge unequivocally said at least 5 or 6 times, if you deny the conduct, not conditioned on where it happened, then I'm sorry, but the case is going to be barred. But Mr. Pruitt was unwilling, not unable, not beyond his intelligence to follow this directive. He simply wanted to vindicate his disciplinary conviction through the vehicle of 1983, and that is precisely what Heck forbids. The result is, as you said, Chief Judge Easterbrook, but there was once Gilbert violated this clear directive,
there some language that you would point me to support what I take to be your current proposition that Magistrate Judge Proud imposed this order as a sanction for disobedience?
No, I don't believe he did. I believe he applied Heck. And the language that I point to you in Heck is that you can't...
It's not a sanction for disobedience. If it is an understanding of Heck, then I thought you had already conceded that it's wrong, that it could be sustained only as a sanction.
I did not. If I conceded that, that was an error, Your Honor.
If it's wrong, then you're taking the position that as a result of Heck, if a prisoner strikes a guard, the guard can do anything he wants in response because the prisoner cannot introduce any evidence of what happens from the moment he strikes the guard.
I disagree, Your Honor. This Court's decisions in Van Gilder, and McCann state otherwise. There's no that was the concern of the court in those cases, that in the Fourth Amendment context or the Eighth Amendment context, prisoners would be left without any vehicle to vindicate their 1983 claims. There was an option for Gilbert at the outset, and he was told time and time again, the magistrate judge boiled this issue down to the simple directive, don't say or do anything implying that you did not hit Officer Cook. But
now you've come back to the possibility that this was a sanction for his disobedience to an order of the court. But that's why I've driven to ask the question, is there anything to indicate that Magistrate Judge Proud thought he was imposing a sanction? He's not talking that way.
No, he's not talking that way. There's nothing to indicate that. And that's why I believe Magistrate Judge Proud was simply applying the simple command in Heck, you can't do or say anything that necessarily implies the invalidity. Now, if the jury had heard evidence about, and the jury did hear evidence six or seven times, this was an alleged punch, this was an alleged hitting, questions designed to elicit the physical impossibility based on the positions of the guards. The cat was out of the bag, and there was no fixing it. And if the jury came back with a verdict...
It was out of the bag, but in the chuck hole.
If the jury came back with a verdict in favor of Mr. Gilbert after having heard this, and perhaps after the case continuing into day two with further questions of alleged punches and Mr. Gilbert's witnesses, which he's noted, I can't control what my witnesses from Tampa are going to say, how will we ever know at the end of the day that the jury...
Easy. The judge instructs the jury that it must assume that Gilbert struck a guard. That is just an established fact. And it's normally what happens when you have a claim of issue preclusion in civil litigation. The jury will be told that fact X is established and incontestable. And the question it has to resolve is whether after that incontestable thing happened, some illegal conduct took place. A perfectly simple thing for a jury to do.
And no doubt, Magistrate Judge Proud struggled with how to handle this. He got off the bench several times. But if I may turn briefly to the Pruitt issue, I want to emphasize that these issues are intertwined. I want to come back to the idea that Mr. Gilbert, it was not beyond his ability. This was his theory of the case. He previewed this theory for the magistrate judge and then delivered on it. He said he was out never to show that he was out to show that he never struck Cook. In no clearer terms could his approach necessarily imply the invalidity of his conviction for hitting Cook. When the magistrate judge considered Mr. Gilbert's request for counsel in November, he correctly followed the Pruitt standard, considering complexity and competency, and circumstances did not change at trial. I want to emphasize that the magistrate judge did not perceive Mr. Gilbert's mention of counsel the morning of trial to be a bona fide request for counsel. And that's a reasonable conclusion because Mr. Gilbert backed off of it. He said moments later, let the cards fall where they may. I think I could handle this, which implies that he understood the eight or nine warnings. Don't say you didn't hit Mr. Cook. So Mr. Gilbert's competency certainly didn't decline from November to February. He made no indication of that. And the case did not get appreciably more difficult because the magistrate judge boiled Heck down to its simple directive, don't say or deny that you hit Officer Cook. Mr. Gilbert couldn't follow that, didn't want to follow that, and the court was left with no other option than to dismiss on the grounds of Heck. For all of these reasons, Your Honors, we urge the court to affirm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Siegel. Anything further, Ms. Cottrell? Well, Ms. Cottrell, we want to thank you and your law firm for your willingness to take this case on behalf of Mr. Gilbert, and we appreciate your assistance both to your client and the court. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.